The ink on her final letter had dried exactly 4 years and 8 months ago. He never answered. Clara hadn't wept since. Instead, she learned to balance an estate ledger, patch a leaking slate roof, and raise a son who inherited the cold gray eyes of a ghost. Now, the heavy oak doors groaned open. The Duke had finally come home. He expected a weeping, devoted wife. Instead, he was about to meet a hardened stranger and a 4-year-old boy who stared back with his exact face. The library at Oakhaven smelled perpetually of damp wool, cold ashes, and slowly decaying paper. Clara sat at the massive mahogany desk, her fingers stained with black ink, tracing a line down a column of numbers. The fire in the hearth was struggling, sputtering against the damp draft that seeped through the poorly sealed window frames. She didn't ring for more coal. Coal was expensive, and the winter was going to be long. She dipped her pen. Scratch, scratch. 5 years ago, she would have sat in the drawing room, wrapped in imported silks, staring out the window and waiting for a carriage. She would have written letters. God, she had written so many letters. 104 of them. She knew the exact number because they were still stacked in the bottom drawer of this very desk, bound with a piece of rough twine. In the beginning, the letters had been desperate, pleading things. Arthur, the roof in the west wing has collapsed. Arthur, the tenants are sick. Arthur, I am with child. By the second year, the letters became brief, sterile reports of the estate's failing finances. By the third year, she stopped writing entirely. The silence from his end had been absolute. He was in the continent, serving the crown, securing treaties, or perhaps simply forgetting he had a wife in Somerset. It didn't matter anymore. The silence had ceased to be an open wound and had healed into a thick, unfeeling scar. A dull thud against the floorboards broke her concentration. Clara looked up. Standing in the doorway was a small boy clutching a chipped wooden block. His linen shirt was smudged with soot, and his knees were bare, showing a fresh, angry red scrape. "Leo," Clara said. Her voice wasn't soft. It was practical, grounded. "Did you fall again?" The boy didn't cry. He rarely did. He simply walked forward, his small, bare feet slapping against the cold hardwood, and placed the wooden block on the edge of her ledger. He looked up at her. It was a physical jolt, every single time. It was the only thing in her life that still managed to hurt. Leo had her dark hair, but his eyes were a startling icy gray. Arthur's eyes. They were eyes that seemed to judge the world, even from the face of a 4-year-old. They held no warmth, only a piercing, quiet observation. Clara reached out, her calloused thumb brushing the soot from his cheek. "Go to Mrs. Gable in the kitchen. Tell her to wash that knee with carbolic soap. It will sting. Don't whine." Leo nodded once, a sharp, precise movement, and turned around, marching back out into the cavernous hallway. Clara watched him go, a tight, heavy knot forming in her throat. She swallowed it down. There was no room for sentimentality today. The grain merchants were demanding payment. She turned back to the ledger, but before the pen could touch the paper, the sharp, frantic clatter of hooves echoed in the courtyard. Clara didn't jump. She simply paused, the ink dripping from the nib onto the blotter, forming a perfect black circle. Visitors were rare. Messengers were rarer. She stood, the heavy wool of her skirt brushing against the floor, and walked to the window. Through the rain-streaked glass, she saw a rider dismounting, his horse lathered and steaming in the cold air. The man was tossing a leather pouch to the stable boy. He looked impatient. He wore the livery of the capital. Clara felt a strange cold settling in her stomach. It wasn't dread. It wasn't joy. It was the deeply annoying realization that her tightly controlled world was about to be disrupted. She walked out of the library and into the main foyer just as the heavy front doors were opened by the footman. The messenger stepped inside, dripping rainwater onto the flagstones. He looked around the dim, drafty hall with thinly veiled disdain before his eyes landed on Clara. He didn't recognize her as the Duchess. She was wearing a faded gray day dress, her hair pulled back in a severe, practical knot, lacking any jewelry or ornament. "Message for the Duchess of Westford," the man said, holding out a wax-sealed letter. "I will take it," Clara said, her voice flat. She didn't extend her hand immediately. She let him wait a second longer than necessary before taking the damp parchment. The seal was intact. The heavy, imposing crest of the Duke of Westford pressed into the red wax. Arthur. She didn't tear it open with trembling fingers. She walked back into the library, picked up a silver letter opener, and sliced through the top with surgical precision. The note inside was painfully brief. Just two lines, written in a sharp, slanted hand that she hadn't seen in half a decade. "Duties concluded. Returning to Oakhaven. Expect my arrival by dusk on the 14th. Clara looked at the date on the top of the parchment. Then she looked out the window at the darkening sky. Today was the 14th. Dusk was exactly 2 hours away. She let out a short, harsh breath that might have been a laugh if it had any humor in it. 5 years. Not a single reply to 100 letters, and he gives her 2 hours' notice. Clara walked to the bell pull and yanked it sharply. When Mrs. Gable appeared, wiping flour from her hands, Clara didn't look up from the ledger she had reopened. "The Duke is arriving in 2 hours," Clara said, her tone as casual as if she were ordering tea. "Have the fires lit in the master suite. Don't bother with the good silver. It's still locked in the vault and I don't have the time to polish it. And keep the boy in the nursery." Mrs. Gable's jaw dropped. "His Grace? Coming back? Today?" "Yes," Clara said, dipping her pen back into the ink. "And tell the stable master to lay down fresh straw. It's going to be a wet night." By 5 o'clock, the rain had turned from a steady drizzle into a driving sheet of water. The wind howled around the stone turrets of Oakhaven, rattling the loose panes of glass in the foyer. Clara stood at the bottom of the grand staircase, her hands folded in front of her. She had not changed her dress. She had not pinned a ribbon in her hair. She simply stood in the dim light of the single oil lamp that had been lit, waiting. The crunch of heavy wooden wheels on wet gravel cut through the sound of the storm. Clara didn't move. She listened to the shouts of the drivers, the snorting of exhausted horses, and the heavy thud of the carriage door opening. Footsteps echoed on the stone steps outside, heavy, deliberate, and undeniably masculine. The heavy oak doors were pulled open by the footmen, a gust of freezing wind blowing dead leaves and rain across the threshold. Arthur stepped inside. He was taller than she remembered. Or perhaps the years had just stripped away any softness he once possessed, leaving behind a hard, unyielding architecture of bone and muscle. His dark riding coat was soaked through, the wool heavy and smelling of horse sweat, wet earth, and tobacco. His face was weathered, his jaw lined with a dark shadow of stubble. He stripped off his leather gloves, the sound a wet smack in the quiet hall, and handed his riding crop to the footman without looking at him. Then he turned and saw her. For a long, agonizing second, the silence in the foyer was absolute. The only sound was the heavy ticking of the grandfather clock in the corner and the rain lashing against the door. Arthur's gaze swept over her. There was a flicker of confusion in those icy gray eyes, followed quickly by a guarded neutrality. He was taking in the faded dress, the calloused hands folded in front of her, the rigid posture. She was not the weeping, desperate girl he had left behind. She looked like a housekeeper. "Clara," he said. His voice was deeper than she remembered, rougher. It grated against the air. "Your Grace," Clara replied. She did not curtsy. She did not take a step forward. Her voice was devoid of any inflection. It was the tone one used to address a tax collector. Arthur's jaw tightened. A muscle leaped just beneath his cheekbone. He took a slow step into the hall, his heavy boots leaving muddy tracks on the stone floor. "The drive is in disrepair. The carriage nearly lost a wheel in a rut near the gate." Clara felt a sharp, cynical prickle of amusement in her chest. 5 years, she thought. 5 years of silence. And his first words are a complaint about the driveway. "Gravel is expensive," Clara said simply. I prioritized patching the roof over the grain silos so the winter harvest wouldn't rot. The drive will have to wait. Arthur stopped, frowning. He looked around the dim hall, noticing for the first time the absence of the tapestries that used to hang on the walls, the single burning lamp, the sheer profound cold of the house. Where are the servants? Why is it so dark in here? We let half the staff go 3 years ago, Clara said, her tone conversational, as if they were discussing the weather. We use oil sparingly. The accounts were in arrears when you left. They are balanced now, but it required austerity. He stared at her. He was waiting for the recriminations. He was waiting for her to scream, to cry, to demand to know why he hadn't written, why he had abandoned her. Clara could see him bracing for the emotional storm. He was a man who knew how to weather storms. He clearly expected to stoically endure her tears. She had no intention of giving him the satisfaction. Your rooms are prepared, Clara said, turning slightly toward the stairs. Mrs. Gable can have a hot meal brought up to you. I imagine you are tired. Arthur caught her arm as she turned. His grip was tight, his fingers cold and damp from the rain. Clara, look at me. She looked down at his hand on her arm, her expression utterly blank, until he slowly released her, his fingers twitching as he pulled away. I received no letters from you after the second year, he said, his voice dropping, carrying a hint of an accusation. I stopped writing them, she answered immediately. I ran out of things to say to a man who didn't exist. Arthur flinched. It was a microscopic movement, but she saw it. He opened his mouth to speak, to offer some excuse of duty or distance, but the words died in his throat. A sound interrupted them. It was the soft, rhythmic padding of bare feet on the wooden floorboards of the upper landing. Clara froze. Her stomach dropped. I told Mrs. Gable to keep him in the nursery. Arthur looked up. At the top of the grand staircase, bathed in the shadows of the upper hall, stood Leo. He was holding a worn cloth rabbit by its ear. He looked down at the massive, dripping stranger in the foyer. The boy said nothing. He didn't hide behind the banister. He simply stood with his back straight, observing the intruder. Arthur squinted through the gloom. Who is that? He asked, his voice sharp. Did one of the servants bring their child into the main house? Clara felt her fingernails bite into the palms of her hands. The air in the foyer seemed to thin, pulling tight like a drawn bowstring. She looked at Arthur, watching the exact moment the annoyance on his face shifted. Arthur took a step toward the base of the stairs. His breath hitched, an ugly, jagged sound in the quiet room. He tilted his head, the dim lamplight finally catching the boy's face. Leo stared back. It was like looking into a brutal, unforgiving mirror. The boy's eyes, those startling, icy, judging gray eyes, locked onto Arthur's. The exact same shade, the exact same heavy brow, the exact same stubborn, silent mouth. Arthur's face drained of color. He looked as though someone had driven a blade into his stomach. He staggered back half a step, his heavy boots scraping against the stone. His chest heaved once, wildly. He turned his head toward Clara, his face a mask of shock, horror, and a sudden desperate realization. Clara, Arthur whispered, his voice trembling, broken completely of its arrogant authority. Clara, whose boy is that? Clara looked at him, feeling absolutely nothing at all. Yours, she said, and turned her back on him. Clara did not look back as she walked down the long, drafty corridor toward the kitchen wing. The floorboards groaned beneath her sensible leather shoes. She could feel the heavy, oppressive silence radiating from the foyer behind her, a physical weight pressing against her shoulder blades. She didn't speed her pace. She didn't run. Her pulse was steady, a slow, dull throb at the base of her throat. In the foyer, Arthur stood frozen. The water from his sodden coat pooled on the flagstones, seeping into the grout. The grandfather clock ticked, each swing of the brass pendulum sounding like a hammer striking an anvil. He slowly raised his head, looking back to the top of the stairs. The landing was empty. The boy, his son, was gone. Arthur's chest felt tight, the air in the room suddenly too thin to breathe. He reached up, his cold, stiff fingers fumbling with the brass buttons of his riding coat. He tore the garment off, letting it drop to the floor with a wet, heavy slap. The scent of rain, horse sweat, and damp wool clung to him. He pressed the heels of his hands into his eyes, pressing until bursts of dull color exploded behind his eyelids. 4 years old. The math was brutally simple. The child had been conceived in the rushing, breathless weeks before he departed for Vienna. Why didn't she tell me? The thought flared with a sudden, hot flash of anger. It was a comfortable, familiar emotion, much easier to handle than the crushing, terrifying guilt that was trying to claw its way up his throat. He grasped onto the anger. It propelled him forward. He didn't go to the prepared master suite. He didn't ask Mrs. Gable for the hot meal. He followed the path Clara had taken, his heavy boots echoing loudly in the quiet house. He found her back in the library. She was not crying. She was not staring blankly into the fire. She was standing by the desk, methodically wiping the spilled ink from the leather blotter with a piece of scrap linen. The room smelled of dried dust and sharp iron gall ink. "Clara," Arthur said. He closed the heavy oak door behind him. The click of the latch was deafening. She didn't pause her wiping. "You are dripping on the Persian rug, Your Grace. It is one of the few we haven't sold to pay the farrier." Arthur ignored the barb. He crossed the room, stopping on the opposite side of the massive mahogany desk. He placed his hands flat on the wood, leaning forward. His knuckles were white. "You hid a son from me," he said, his voice dangerously low, vibrating with a restrained fury. "For 5 years you let me believe I had no heir. You let me sit in foreign courts, entirely ignorant that my own flesh and blood was walking these halls." Clara finally stopped wiping the blotter. She tossed the stained linen into the dying fire. It hissed, a brief plume of acrid smoke rising up the chimney. She looked at him. Her face was a mask of perfectly carved stone. "I hid nothing," she stated flatly. "You kept him a secret." Arthur's voice rose, cracking slightly at the edges. "My son, my heir, do you have any idea what..." "Quiet down," Clara interrupted, her tone sharp, snapping like a dry twig. "Your voice carries, and the boy is a light sleeper." Arthur snapped his mouth shut, his jaw working furiously. He looked at her, truly looked at her. There was no softness left in the woman he had married. Her cheekbones were sharp, her skin pale, lacking the flush of youth she had possessed at 19. Clara walked around the desk. She didn't look at him. She knelt down, the rough wool of her skirt pooling around her on the floor. She reached for the bottom drawer on the left side of the desk. It stuck, warped by the dampness of the room. She gave it a hard, unceremonious yank. It slid open with a screech of wood on wood. She reached inside and pulled out a heavy, rectangular bundle. It was thick, bound tightly in rough brown twine. She stood up and dropped the bundle onto the desk. It landed with a heavy, dead thud, kicking up a tiny puff of dust. Arthur stared at it. "What is that?" 104 letters, Clara said. Her voice was terrifyingly calm. "I wrote one every week for the first 2 years." She reached out, her fingers catching the knot of the twine. She pulled. The rough string gave way, and the thick stack of envelopes spilled across the dark wood, sliding and fanning out like a deck of morbid playing cards. Every single one was sealed. Every single one was addressed to the Duke of Westford, care of the foreign embassies. Every single one bore the unbroken red wax crest of the diplomatic courier service. "They were returned to me," Clara said, staring at the scattered parchment. "Marked undeliverable, or simply sent back in the diplomatic pouches. You didn't even open them to reject them. You just refused the parcels entirely." Arthur stared at the letters. His breath hitched. He remembered the busy, brightly lit rooms in Vienna and Paris. He remembered the clerks bringing him silver trays piled high with correspondence. He remembered waving them away, instructing his secretary to handle the domestic matters. I am negotiating the borders of nations, he had told himself. I have no time for the complaints of a lonely girl in Somerset. Clara reached into the pile. Her fingers unerringly found a specific envelope near the bottom. The paper was slightly yellowed, the edges curled. She picked it up and held it out to him. Letter number 12, Clara said, her voice dropping to a harsh whisper. Written 4 months after you left. In it, I told you the physician had confirmed my condition. Arthur didn't take the letter. He couldn't move his hands. They felt like lead. Clara dropped the letter onto the desk, right in front of him. She picked up another. Letter number 36. Written after 30 hours of labor, while the sheets were still soaked with my blood. In it, I told you that you had a son. I told you I named him Leo, because he fought for every breath he took. She dropped it next to the first. She picked up a third. Letter number 42. I begged you to come home. The winter was brutal. The boy caught a fever, and I thought he was going to die. I sat by his crib for 6 nights, putting wet rags on his forehead, praying to a god I no longer believed in, because his father was too busy dancing with Austrian countesses to read a piece of paper. She threw the third letter. It hit Arthur in the chest, sliding down his waistcoat to land on the floor at his boots. I didn't hide him, Clara said, her voice devoid of anger, devoid of sadness. It was simply the hollow, echoing truth. You just didn't care to look. Arthur stared at the letter on the floor. The silence in the library was absolute, save for the wind howling against the glass. He had come home expecting to demand obedience to reclaim his life. Instead, he found himself standing in the ruins of a home he had burned down without ever striking a match. The morning light filtering through the tall, arched windows of the dining room was the color of dirty dishwater. It did nothing to warm the room. Clara sat at the head of the long oak table, a position she had occupied for 5 years. She was scraping a thin layer of sharp cheddar cheese onto a piece of hard toast. Butter was a luxury currently reserved for Sunday suppers. To her right sat Leo. He was meticulously cutting a single piece of sausage into perfectly uniform squares, his small brow furrowed in intense concentration. He wore a clean, albeit faded, wool tunic that smelled faintly of lye soap. The heavy doors at the end of the room swung open. Arthur walked in. He had changed into a clean day suit of dark charcoal, his cravat tied with crisp precision. He looked imposing, powerful, and entirely out of place in the austere, chilly room. The scent of bay rum and expensive shaving soap cut through the smell of cold porridge and damp stone. Clara didn't look up from her toast. Leo paused his cutting, the knife hovering over his plate. He turned his head, those icy gray eyes locking onto the man walking toward them. Arthur stopped halfway down the table. He looked at the vast expanse of empty chairs, then at the meager spread on the silver platters. There were no poached eggs, no smoked kippers, no hothouse fruits, just porridge, hard bread, and a small wedge of cheese. Good morning, Arthur said. His voice was stiff, formal. Clara took a bite of her toast. The crunch was loud in the quiet room. She chewed, swallowed, and washed it down with a sip of lukewarm, oversteeped tea. There is porridge in the tureen. It's likely cold by now. We eat at 7. Arthur glanced at the grandfather clock. It was nearly 8. He pulled out the chair opposite Clara, the wooden legs scraping harshly against the floorboards. He sat down. He didn't reach for the food. His eyes were fixed on the boy.
Oh, Leo, Arthur said softly. The name felt strange on his tongue, alien and heavy. Leo didn't respond. He simply stared back, his expression entirely unreadable. He slowly lowered his knife, picked up a perfectly square piece of sausage with his fingers, and put it in his mouth. He chewed slowly, his eyes never leaving Arthur's face.
Arthur felt a cold sweat prickle the back of his neck. It was uncanny. The boy didn't have the fidgety, nervous energy of a child. He had the still, calculating presence of a predator assessing a threat. He doesn't speak to strangers, Clara said, her tone conversational as she reached for the teapot. It saves him the trouble of forming attachments. Arthur's jaw tightened. I am not a stranger. I am his father. Biology is a technicality, Clara replied, pouring a thin stream of dark tea into her cup. You are a man who arrived in a carriage last night. The postman is a more familiar figure to him. Arthur placed his hands flat on the table. He wanted to argue, to raise his voice, to assert his authority. But the crushing weight of the unread letters in the library pressed down on his lungs. He had no authority here. He was a ghost haunting a house that had long ago learned to survive without him.
I intend to change that, Arthur said, his voice low, a promise to himself as much as to her. Clara finally looked up at him. Her dark eyes were devoid of hope or malice. You are welcome to try, but do not expect me to facilitate the introduction. You broke it, Your Grace. You can figure out how to mend it. She pushed her chair back and stood up. Finish your breakfast, Leo. Mrs. Gable needs the ashes cleared from the kitchen hearth.
You have him clearing ashes? Arthur demanded, genuine shock fracturing his stoic facade. He is the heir to a dukedom. He should be with a tutor, learning Greek and mathematics.
Clara stopped, resting her hand on the back of her chair.
The estate doesn't run on Greek. It runs on labor. A tutor costs £40 a year. The roof over the tenant cottages cost £50. I chose the roof. If you wanted him to be a scholar, you should have paid the bills. She turned and walked out of the room, leaving the door open behind her. Arthur sat in the echoing silence of the dining room. He looked across the table. Leo had finished his sausage. The boy carefully wiped his mouth with a linen napkin, placed it perfectly parallel to his plate, and slid off his chair. As Leo walked toward the door, Arthur reached into his coat pocket.
Leo, wait.
The boy stopped, turning his head slightly. Arthur pulled out a small, intricately carved wooden horse. He had bought it from a street vendor in Prague, an impulse purchase he hadn't fully understood at the time. I brought this for you. He set the horse on the edge of the table. Leo looked at the toy. He walked back to the table, his small footsteps silent on the floorboards. He stood on his tiptoes to peer at the carved wood. He reached out and touched the horse's mane with one small, soot-stained finger. Arthur held his breath. A tiny, desperate spark of hope ignited in his chest. Leo pushed the horse. It slid across the polished wood of the table, stopping just short of Arthur's empty plate.
The front left leg is shorter than the right, Leo said. His voice was quiet, precise, and devoid of any childish lisp. It won't stand straight. Without another word, the boy turned and walked out of the dining room, his small shoes tapping down the corridor toward the kitchen.
Arthur sat alone at the massive table. He looked down at the wooden horse. He tipped it with his index finger. It wobbled, uneven and deeply flawed, before falling over onto its side with a dull, hollow clack. He squeezed his eyes shut, the smell of old pine and bitter tea thick in the air. For the first time in his life, the Duke of Westford had absolutely no idea what to do next. The stables smelled of ammonia, wet rot, and sour hay. Arthur stood in the center of the cobbled aisle, staring at the empty stalls. Out of 20 boxes, only 3 were occupied. Heavy, thick-legged draft horses stood in the gloom, their coats matted with dried mud.
Where are the hunters? Arthur asked. His breath plumed in the freezing morning air.
Old Cobb, the stable master whose back was permanently bowed from a lifetime of labor, didn't stop raking the soiled straw.
Sold, Your Grace, 3 winters back. The oats were needed for the plow teams, and Her Grace said we couldn't feed animals that only existed to jump over hedges.
Arthur rubbed his jaw. The stubble was rough against his palm. He had spent his time in Vienna arguing over the placement of cavalry battalions on maps. Here, his wife had sold his prize-winning thoroughbreds to keep the farm running. He turned on his heel and walked out into the driving drizzle. He found Clara 2 miles away, down by the old grist mill. The river was swollen, choked with brown foam and dead branches. A heavy timber wagon had sunk axle-deep into the gelatinous gray mud of the riverbank. 4 tenant farmers covered in muck were straining with long wooden levers against the rear wheels. And Clara was in the mud with them. She wore a heavy woolen cloak over her faded dress, the hem pinned up to her knees, exposing thick, practical wool stockings and heavy men's boots. Her bare hands were wrapped around the slick, muddy wood of a lever, her knuckles white. Rain plastered loose strands of dark hair to her forehead. She was shouting over the roar of the river. On three! Push against the block! One, two, three! She threw her weight against the pole. The men grunted. The draft horses screamed and lunged into their collars. The wagon groaned, slid an inch, and then sank back into the muck with a sickening squelch. Clara stumbled forward, catching herself on the muddy side of the cart. She wiped her face with the back of a filthy hand, leaving a smear of brown across her pale cheek. Arthur felt a hot, shameful flush creep up his neck. The Duchess of Westford was wrestling a wagon out of the mud like a common laborer. He strode down the embankment, his leather boots slipping on the wet grass. "Stop this!" Arthur barked, his voice carrying the sharp, practiced authority of a military commander. The tenant farmers froze. They looked at the tall, impeccably dressed Duke, and then immediately looked away, dropping their eyes to the mud. They didn't bow. They didn't speak. They looked to Clara. Clara straightened slowly. She let go of the lever. She didn't look embarrassed. She looked profoundly annoyed. "What are you doing here?" she asked. Her chest was heaving, her breath coming in sharp, visible puffs. The smell of the river, decaying leaves and cold silt, clung to her. "I'm stopping my wife from breaking her back in a ditch," Arthur said, stepping into the mud. The gray sludge immediately crested over the polished toes of his boots. He looked at the men. "Unload the grain sacks. You're too heavy. Carry them across the bridge by hand and pull the empty wagon out." The men shifted uncomfortably. One of them, a man with a graying beard, spoke to the ground. "It's seed grain, Your Grace. If we drag the sacks through this rain, the moisture will ruin the lot. It has to stay under the canvas on the cart." Arthur's mouth formed a hard line. He was a man accustomed to giving orders that were instantly obeyed, regardless of physics or weather. He opened his mouth to override the farmer.
"Miller is right," Clara cut in. Her voice was flat, tired. She didn't look at Arthur. She looked at the stuck wheel. "We need more leverage. Bring the timber block under the left axle."
Arthur stepped forward, grabbing her arm. "Clara, enough. You're soaked to the bone. Go back to the house. I will manage this." Clara looked down at his clean, pale hand wrapped around her mud-caked sleeve. She didn't yank her arm away. She simply stared at his hand until he felt the absurdity of his grip and let go.
"Manage what?" Clara asked softly. The roar of the water almost drowned her out, but the cold contempt in her voice was piercing. "Do you know the tension threshold of an oak axle? Do you know the difference between winter wheat and rye seed? These men do not know you. They answer to me. Stand aside, Arthur. You are in the way." It was the first time she had used his Christian name since he returned. It felt like a slap.
Arthur stood frozen in the mud. He watched as his wife turned her back on him, grabbed the muddy lever and signaled the men. He watched the muscles in her back strain. He watched her fight the earth. And for the first time, he realized that Oakhaven didn't need a duke. It already had a master. He didn't retreat to the bank. He swallowed the thick, burning lump of his own uselessness. He walked to the rear of the wagon, stripped off his heavy coat, and threw it carelessly onto a relatively dry patch of grass. His linen shirt immediately soaked through in the rain. He didn't give an order. He wedged his shoulder beneath the slick, muddy timber of the cart's frame, right next to the tenant farmer with the gray beard. The smell of wet wool, unwashed bodies, and raw earth was overpowering. Clara saw him out of the corner of her eye. She paused for a fraction of a second, her jaw tightening. She didn't tell him to leave. "On three!" Clara shouted again. Arthur dug his boots into the sludge. He pushed until his vision blurred, until the wood bit into his shoulder bone, matching the desperate silent rhythm of the men around him, pushing until the wagon finally tore free from the mud with a violent crack. The old conservatory at the back of the house was a graveyard of ambition. Half the glass panes in the domed roof were shattered, letting in the cold draft. Dead brown vines clung desperately to the rusted iron trellises, brittle as old bones. The air smelled of damp earth and rust. Arthur found Leo sitting on the cracked stone floor. The boy had a small wooden bucket beside him and a heavy iron hammer resting on his lap. He was picking up bent, rusted nails from a scatter on the floor, placing them on a flat paving stone, and methodically striking them with the hammer to straighten them out. Clang, clang. The sound echoed sharply in the cavernous room. Arthur stood in the doorway, his shoulder aching violently from the wagon. His shirt was dried tight to his skin, carrying the stench of river mud. He watched the boy. Leo's strikes were precise. He didn't mash the metal, he coaxed it back into a usable shape, tossing the straight nails into the bucket. Arthur walked in. His boots crunched on fragments of broken glass. Leo didn't look up. Clang. Arthur lowered himself slowly onto the cold stone floor, sitting cross-legged a few feet from the boy. He felt massive and clumsy in the delicate ruined space. "Saving nails?" Arthur asked. His voice was quiet, stripped of its usual booming resonance. Leo picked up another bent piece of iron. "The blacksmith charges a farthing for a dozen new ones. These just need to be hit right." He placed the nail on the stone. Clang. Arthur watched the boy's small, soot-stained fingers. "I used to play in here, when I was a boy." Leo didn't pause. "There is nothing to play with. It's just dirt." "There used to be lemon trees," Arthur said, the memory surfacing unbidden, smelling faintly of citrus and damp, warm earth. "My mother had them brought over from Italy. They smelled very sweet in the winter." Leo tossed a straightened nail into the bucket. It landed with a dull ping. "Lemon trees die in the frost. It was stupid to bring them here." Arthur flinched. The boy's pragmatism was brutal. It was Clara's survival instinct filtered through a child's absolute lack of sentimentality. "Perhaps," Arthur murmured. He reached out and picked up a bent nail from the pile. It was cold and rough with rust. He held it up. "May I try?" Leo looked at him. Those terrifying gray eyes scanned Arthur's face. He didn't smile. He didn't offer the hammer. He simply pushed the heavy iron tool across the stone floor toward Arthur. Arthur took it. The handle was smooth from use. He placed the bent nail on the flat stone. He wasn't a craftsman. He was a swordsman, a horseman. He brought the hammer down with far too much force. Crack. The nail bent completely backward, forming a useless, twisted U-shape. The hammer slipped, striking the stone and sending a painful vibration up Arthur's forearm. Leo sighed. It wasn't a childish sigh. It was the heavy exhale of a disappointed foreman. The boy reached over, took the twisted nail from the stone, and dropped it into a separate, smaller pile of useless scraps. "You hit it from the top," Leo stated softly. "You have to strike the curve. If you force it down, you just break the iron." Arthur stared at the scrap pile. "I see." He reached for another nail. He set it down. He adjusted his grip on the hammer, softening his hold. He tapped the curve of the metal. Tink, tink. The nail slowly began to yield, straightening out against the stone. "Like that?" Arthur asked, his chest tight with a bizarre, suffocating hope. Leo watched the nail. He gave a single, microscopic nod. "Yes." Neither of them noticed Clara standing in the doorway. She stood in the shadows, her muddy cloak dripping onto the floorboards of the corridor. Her hands were raw and blistered from the lever. She watched the massive Duke of Westford sitting on the floor in the dirt, carefully tapping a rusted nail under the watchful eye of a 4-year-old boy. A sudden sharp ache bloomed beneath Clara's ribs. It was terrifying. It wasn't hatred. It was a vicious, unwanted pain of longing. A ghost of a thought whispered in the back of her mind. This is what it could have been. A father. A son. A family. She crushed the thought instantly. It was a dangerous, poisonous thing. Hope had nearly killed her 5 years ago. Hope was what made you wait by the window. Hope was what made you write 104 letters into a void. She had survived by excising hope, cutting it out of herself like a rot. She could not afford to let it back in. She could not afford to let Arthur crack the foundation she had built out of sheer, unyielding ice. Clara stepped fully into the doorway, her boots scraping loudly against the wood. Arthur's head snapped up. Leo stopped his sorting. "Leo," Clara said. Her voice was cold, perfectly even. "Leave the iron. Mrs. Gable has a bucket of potatoes that needs scrubbing." Arthur frowned, the hammer still in his hand. "He's helping me. He's teaching me how to fix these."
"He is doing chores," Clara corrected smoothly. "As you should be, if you intend to stay, Your Grace. The ledgers for the North Tennant farms are on my desk. They are 5 years out of date. Since you have such an affinity for fixing broken things, you can start there." She didn't wait for his reply. She turned to her son. "Come, Leo."
Leo stood up immediately. He didn't look back at Arthur. He didn't say goodbye. He simply walked to his mother, his small boots crunching over the broken glass. Clara took his hand, a rare gesture of physical contact, and led him away down the hall. Arthur sat alone in the dirt. He looked down at the straightened nail on the stone block. He picked it up. It was rough, imperfect, and still heavily scarred with rust, but it was straight. He closed his fist around it, the metal biting sharply into his palm, and listened to the fading sound of their footsteps. The library was freezing. Arthur had let the fire die hours ago, unwilling to ring for a servant to bring up coal that he now knew the estate could barely afford. The only light came from a single sputtering tallow candle on the massive mahogany desk. It smelled of rendered animal fat and burning string. Spread before him were the estate ledgers, 5 heavy leather-bound books.
He had expected disorganization. He had expected the frantic, messy accounting of a young woman overwhelmed by debt. What he found was far worse. It was a flawless, surgical autopsy of his abandonment. Arthur turned a crisp, yellowed page. His finger traced a line down the column of expenses from 4 years ago. The ink was faded, written in Clara's sharp, unhesitating hand.
"November 14th, apothecary fee for child's lung fever, £2. November 15th, sale of rosewood pianoforte, plus £15. November 18th, coal for nursery, £4. November 20th, sale of Duchess's riding habits, 3, silk-lined, plus £6. He stared at the numbers until they blurred. She had sold her clothes to buy coal to keep his son alive. He turned another page, the paper dry and brittle under his thumb. "December 1st. Crown taxes due, £140. December 2nd. Sale of Oakhaven emerald perruque, plus £200. Arthur's stomach bottomed out. The emerald perruque was an heirloom. It had been his wedding gift to her. She hadn't sold it for dresses or trips to London. She had sold it to pay the taxes on a house he had left her to rot in. He closed the ledger. The heavy cover fell shut with a muffled thud that seemed to echo in the cavernous room. He pressed the heels of his hands against his eyes. The silence of Oakhaven was no longer just empty. It was accusing. Every drafty corridor, every stripped wall, every unlit fireplace was screaming at him. He couldn't sit there anymore. The air in the library felt toxic. Arthur stood, taking the candle, and walked out into the pitch-black hallway. The floorboards were freezing through the soles of his boots. He walked up the grand staircase, his shadow stretching monstrously tall against the peeling plaster walls. He turned down the east wing. His wing. The master suite was there, where Mrs. Gable had grudgingly lit a fire for him. He passed his door. He kept walking until he reached the far end of the corridor, where the servants' quarters used to intersect with the main house. The floorboards here were uncarpeted, rough-hewn oak. A thin sliver of light bled from beneath a heavy door. Arthur stopped. He didn't knock. He simply stood there, listening to the agonizingly quiet sound coming from the other side. Snip. Pull. He pushed the door open. It creaked violently on dry hinges. Clara was sitting by the window. The room was no larger than a dressing closet. It was entirely devoid of decoration. There was a narrow iron bed, a washstand, and a single wooden chair. She was hunched over a pile of dark wool, a heavy needle in her hand. She was patching the knee of Leo's trousers. The room was brutally cold. She was wearing her outdoor cloak indoors, her breath forming faint white plumes in the dim light. She didn't jump when the door opened. She merely paused her stitching, her needle hovering over the thick wool. She looked up. The hollows beneath her eyes were bruised, a deep, exhausted purple. "The ledgers are not in this room, Arthur," she said. Her voice was a dry rasp. Arthur stepped inside. The ceiling was low, pressing down on his shoulders. He looked at the narrow bed. "Why are you sleeping here? The mistress's chambers are in the south wing. The south wing requires 3 hearths to keep the damp out of the walls," Clara replied, pushing the needle through the tough fabric. "This room is small. Body heat warms it faster. It is efficient." "It's a servant's room." "I am a servant," she said, biting off the end of the heavy thread with her teeth. "I just have a title." Arthur felt a muscle twitch in his jaw. He stepped closer. The smell of cold wool, camphor, and exhausted sweat hung heavily in the air. "I read the ledgers." "Then you know we cannot afford a new roof for the stables before spring," she said, smoothing the patched wool over her knee. "You sold the emeralds," he said. His voice cracked. It wasn't a question. Clara finally looked up, her dark eyes locking onto his. There was no shame in her gaze, no regret, just a terrifying, hollow pragmatism. Taxes were due. The magistrate threatened to seize the tenant lands. The stones were pretty, Arthur, but you cannot feed people with pretty stones. "You should have sent to my bankers in London," he whispered, stepping closer until his knees nearly brushed the hem of her cloak. "You shouldn't have had to—" "I did," she cut him off, her voice suddenly sharp, slicing through the freezing air. "I sent 3 letters to your bankers. They replied that His Grace had frozen the estate accounts pending his return, and no funds could be released without your signature. You locked the vault, Arthur, and then you threw away the key." Arthur stopped breathing. The memory hit him like a physical blow. 5 years ago, in a fit of arrogant annoyance over her constant letters asking for repairs, he had sent a quick instruction to London to hold the discretionary funds. He had meant it to last a month, a petty punishment to force her to manage better. He had forgotten. He had gone to Vienna and simply forgotten. He sank to his knees. The rough wood of the floor bit into his kneecaps. He was a tall man, a proud man, but right now, kneeling in front of her small wooden chair, he felt entirely insignificant. "Clara," he breathed, the word shattering in his throat. She recoiled. It was a tiny, visceral movement, but she pulled her knees back, away from his proximity. "Do not," she warned, her voice trembling with sudden, fierce venom. "Do not kneel. Do not apologize. I do not have the time to coddle your guilt." "I left you to starve, but we didn't," she stated, her chin lifting, a sudden fierce pride burning in her exhausted eyes. "I didn't. I kept the house. I kept the farms. I kept my son alive. We survived you, Arthur. Do not come back here and try to turn my survival into your tragedy." The fever hit her the following afternoon. It didn't announce itself with dramatic swooning. It crept in like a thief. Clara was in the kitchen courtyard, sorting a delivery of shriveled winter carrots. Arthur was watching from the window of the library, the open ledger forgotten on the desk. He noticed the way her hands were shaking. She dropped a carrot. She bent to pick it up, and instead of straightening smoothly, she caught the edge of the stone trough, her knuckles turning white. She stayed bent over for 10 long seconds. Arthur was out the door before he made a conscious decision to move. The courtyard was slick with freezing rain. He reached her just as her knees gave out. He caught her by the shoulders, pulling her back against his chest. She felt terrifyingly light, her bones sharp against his hands. Heat radiated through the damp wool of her cloak. It was a ferocious, unnatural heat. "Clara," Arthur said, turning her around. Her face was flushed a violent red, yet her lips were tinged blue. Her eyes were glassy, unfocused. She stared at his cravat, her brow furrowing in a confusion. "The carrots," she mumbled, her voice thick and slurred. "They need to be buried in the sand cellar, or the rot will spread." "Damn the carrots," Arthur snapped. He swept one arm under her knees and the other behind her back, lifting her clean off the wet cobblestones. She fought him. It was a weak, pathetic struggle, her fists weakly batting against his chest. "Put me down. I have to finish. If I don't finish the ledger..." "I'll do the ledger," he said, holding her tighter against him, marching toward the heavy kitchen doors. "I'll bury the carrots. Be still." "Don't touch me," she gasped, her breath hot against his neck, smelling of bitter tea and rising sickness. "I don't need you. I don't need..." Her head rolled back against his shoulder, her eyes fluttering shut. She had simply run out of fuel. The brutal, unyielding machine she had turned herself into had finally broken down. Arthur kicked the kitchen door open, startling Mrs. Gable, who dropped a wooden spoon onto the floor. "Get hot water," Arthur ordered, his voice echoing off the vaulted stone ceiling. "And camphor, bring them to the master suite."
"The master suite, Your Grace?" Mrs. Gable stammered. "But the mistress sleeps in the east wing."
"She sleeps in the master suite now," Arthur roared, already moving past her toward the back stairs.
"Move, woman!"
He carried her up the stairs, his boots taking the steps two at a time. He bypassed the narrow, freezing servants' room entirely, pushing open the heavy double doors of his own chambers. The fire had been kept roaring here. The room was stiflingly warm, smelling of wood smoke and polished leather. He laid her on the massive four-poster bed. She shivered violently, curling into a tight ball, her teeth chattering so hard he could hear the clicking from across the room. Arthur didn't call for a maid. He stripped off his coat and waistcoat, rolling up the sleeves of his linen shirt. He unclasped her sodden cloak, his large, clumsy fingers fumbling with the intricate brass hook at her throat. He pulled the heavy, wet wool away from her. Her dress underneath was damp from sweat and the lingering moisture of the river mud. The door opened behind him. It wasn't Mrs. Gable. Arthur turned. Leo stood in the doorway. The boy was holding his wooden bucket of straightened nails. He stared at his mother on the bed, and then at Arthur. For the first time, the terrifyingly blank expression on the boy's face cracked. His small hands tightened on the bucket handle until his knuckles were pure white. His lower lip gave a microscopic tremble. Fear. The boy was terrified. Arthur felt his heart fracture. He walked over to the door and crouched down, bringing himself to eye level with his son. "She has a fever," Arthur said. He kept his voice steady, low, and incredibly calm. "From the river yesterday, she pushed herself too hard." Leo stared at him, his gray eyes shining with unshed tears. "People die from fevers. The apothecary said so." "She's not going to die," Arthur said. He didn't offer a gentle platitude. He offered a hard, unyielding vow. He reached out and placed a hand on Leo's small shoulder. The boy flinched, but he didn't pull away. "I will not let her. Do you understand me? I'm not going anywhere, and neither is she." Leo looked at the large, warm hand on his shoulder. He swallowed hard. "Mrs. Gable is bringing the camphor." "Good," Arthur said, standing up. "Come inside. Close the door. It's drafty." For the next 10 hours, the Duke of Westford did not sit down. When Mrs. Gable brought the supplies, he dismissed her. He bathed Clara's burning forehead with cool water. He mixed the foul-smelling camphor with goose grease and rubbed it into her chest as she choked on dry, rattling coughs. When she thrashed in delirium, murmuring frantic numbers about grain silos and unpaid taxes, he held her down, his heavy hands pinning her wrists to the mattress so she wouldn't hurt herself. And through it all, Leo sat on a heavy wingback chair in the corner of the room, his legs dangling over the edge, watching the man he didn't know fight a war for his mother's life. Near midnight, the fever finally broke. Clara stopped thrashing. Her breathing slowed, shifting from shallow, painful rasps to deep, even draws. A sheen of cool sweat broke out across her forehead. Arthur sat in a chair pulled close to the bed. His back screamed in agony. His hands were stained with grease and soot. He leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees, and let his head drop into his hands. He was more exhausted than he had ever been after a 3-day cavalry march. A small, quiet sound made him open his eyes. Leo had slid off his chair. The boy walked across the room, his bare feet silent on the thick Persian rug. He stopped next to Arthur. He didn't say a word. He simply reached out and placed his small, cold hand on top of Arthur's arm. Arthur stared at the tiny hand against his dirty sleeve. He didn't move. He barely breathed. He simply sat in the quiet, dim room, listening to the steady breathing of his wife and feeling the terrifying, fragile weight of his son's touch. The smell of burnt tallow and sharp, bitter camphor was the first thing Clara registered. She opened her eyes. The ceiling was wrong. It wasn't the flat, water-stained plaster of the cramped room in the east wing. It was high, vaulted, and framed in heavy carved mahogany. She turned her head, the rough linen of the pillowcase scraping against her cheek. Her mouth tasted of old copper and sour breath. Her limbs felt as though they had been filled with wet lead, utterly useless and heavy. She was in the master suite. She slowly pushed herself up onto her elbows, a dull ache throbbing at the base of her skull. The fire in the hearth was dying, a bed of pulsing orange embers fighting against the morning light bleeding through the heavy velvet curtains. A shadow moved in the corner. Arthur was slouched in the heavy wingback chair. He looked terrible. His cravat was gone, his collar open, revealing the dark hair on his chest. His usually pristine linen shirt was wrinkled, stained with grease, soot, and sweat. A thick, dark shadow of a beard covered his jaw, stripping away the polished veneer of the diplomat and leaving behind a haggard, exhausted man. His head rested against his hand, his eyes closed. Clara shifted. The mattress groaned. Arthur's eyes snapped open instantly. He didn't stretch. He didn't yawn. He leaned forward, his gaze locking onto hers with a sharp, frantic intensity. He pushed himself out of the chair, his knees popping audibly in the quiet room, and crossed the distance to the bed. He didn't try to touch her. He stopped a foot away, his hands hovering awkwardly by his sides. "You're awake," Arthur said. His voice was a ruined, gravelly rasp. "Water," Clara croaked. Her throat felt like cracked leather. Arthur turned swiftly to the washstand. He poured water from a porcelain pitcher into a glass, his large hand shaking slightly, spilling a few drops onto the wood. He brought it back to her. He hesitated, then sat carefully on the edge of the mattress. He slipped one arm behind her shoulders to support her, bringing the glass to her lips. His arm was solid, radiating heat through her thin nightdress. He smelled of wood smoke, stale sweat, and sheer exhaustion. Clara drank. The water was cold and sharp, hurting her throat as it went down, but she drank it all. He lowered her back onto the pillows, pulling the heavy quilt up to her chest. He set the glass down on the bedside table and let out a long, shuddering breath. "The fever broke near midnight," Arthur said, staring at his dirty hands. "You slept through the morning." Clara looked past him. At the foot of the massive bed, curled into a tight ball on top of Arthur's discarded riding coat, was Leo. The boy was fast asleep, his chest rising and falling in a steady, peaceful rhythm. One of his small hands was firmly gripping the lapel of the heavy wool coat. A strange, uncomfortable tightness seized Clara's chest. It wasn't the lingering illness. It was the terrifying realization that her perfectly controlled, isolated world had been breached. She had collapsed, and the walls hadn't fallen. The estate hadn't burned down. "You stayed," Clara said softly, stating a fact rather than asking a question. Arthur finally looked at her.
His gray eyes, usually so cold and unreadable, were raw.
Where else would I be? Vienna. Paris. Drafting a treaty, she replied, the cynicism entirely reflexive, though it lacked its usual venom. She was simply too tired for venom. Arthur didn't flinch. He didn't offer an excuse about his duties to the crown or the importance of his work. He just took the hit.
I resigned my post, he said quietly.
Clara stopped breathing.
You what?
Yesterday morning, I sent a courier to London. I resigned.
Arthur leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees.
I spent 5 years solving the problems of kings I don't care about, while my own wife was dragging carts out of the mud to feed my son. I was an arrogant, blind fool, and I am entirely done with it. Clara stared at the ceiling. Her mind, usually a rapid-fire ledger of tasks and calculations, was blank.
You can't erase 5 years of silence with one night of camphor and water, Arthur.
I know, he said instantly. I don't expect to.
I don't expect forgiveness, Clara. I expect to pay the debt.
She turned her head to look at him.
The debt?
The roof over the grain silos, the bridge at the South Crossing, the lease for the Miller farm. He recited the problems from her ledgers perfectly. He had memorized them.
I will hire a crew for the roof tomorrow. I will sign the bank releases today. You don't have to talk to me. You don't have to forgive me, but you are going to let me do the heavy lifting.
Clara watched him. She wanted to push him away. She wanted to tell him to pack his bags and leave her to her hard, safe life. But the ache in her bones was profound, and the cold reality was that she couldn't carry the weight alone anymore. She was breaking. She looked at Leo, still sleeping soundly on his father's coat.
The farrier, Clara whispered, her voice barely carrying over the crackle of the fire.
He needs to be paid by Friday, or he won't shoe the plow horses. Arthur closed his eyes. A muscle leapt in his jaw. It wasn't a declaration of love. It was a chore, but it was also an invitation to stay.
I'll pay the farrier, Arthur said, his voice thick.
He opened his eyes and looked at her, entirely stripped of his pride.
I'll handle it.
Clara didn't smile. She didn't reach for his hand, but she closed her eyes, the tension finally bleeding out of her shoulders, and for the first time in 5 years she let herself rest. The road to redemption at Oakhaven won't be paved with flowery apologies. It will be built with sweat, patience, and repaired roofs. Clara hasn't forgiven him yet, and the Duke has 5 years of brutal silence to make up for. But the ice has finally cracked, and for the first time they're facing the harsh winter together. Did Arthur do enough to earn his place back at the table, or does he still have a long way to go? Let us know your thoughts in the comments.
If you love this grounded, slow-burn drama, hit that like button, share it with your friends, and subscribe so you never miss our next story.